What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping
you? Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Wednesday of Holy Week here on EWTN. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, especially those of you who are not Catholic, well, that's why we are here. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And of course, you can always send us an email anytime you wish. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Aquiles, our producer, Matt Kabinski, our phone screener, Rich Jesse handling social media for us. If you are watching us right now on YouTube or Facebook, well, we're streaming on those platforms right now. You can put your question in the comments box. Rich will see that. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio, and we'd love to answer your question on today's program. Again, the phone number, 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, sir?
I'm learning not to grab the microphone to move it when I need to change positions on the radio because it makes funny noises, and I almost did it, and I stopped myself.
Not only do I thank you, all of our listeners thank you because they hear this big noise, and they're going, what's that?
I was reaching, and I stopped myself. I remembered your friendly admonishment a few minutes ago.
I am so proud of you. We're going to start off kind of heavy today. This is from Richard in Prescott, Arizona. Dr. Anders, your program is inspirational. I believe the souls of the departed who enjoy God's beatific vision already have the resurrected body. Why? In heaven, there is no time. So it seems that the end of times, the final judgment, and the resurrection of the body all happened. God is always present. Past and future are now. We can only speculate. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. That's not what the church teaches.
Okay.
I mean, that's just simply not what the church teaches.
All right.
So, first of all, with respect to there being no time in heaven, only God is timeless. Only God is timeless. Angels and separated souls of humans are not timeless, and we are not timeless. Now, there is a difference in the way time passes for the angels and the separated souls than for us, because, you know, time as we know it is this is something we understand from physics that we didn't know a long time ago. Time is wrapped up into this space-time continuum, and it's all unified in a way that escapes our consciousness. But to escape from matter is to escape from a certain form of temporal existence. But only God truly exists timelessly. And so the scholastic theologians posited a kind of intermediate relationship to time enjoyed by the angels and the separated souls that they called aveternity. It's not eternity. It's sort of midway between eternity
really?
And temporality. Right, exactly.
Okay.
And so, for example, the separated souls experience discursive thought, right? They're able to, say, reason deductively from premise to conclusion. And, you know, succession is a kind of temporal ordering, right?
Okay.
Well, God doesn't do that. Catholic doctrine teaches that God does not have discursive thoughts. God knows everything in a single permanent instant. That's not how the angels know. It's not how the separated souls know. So it's actually not strictly true to imagine that the blessed dead enjoy timelessness. That's not true.
All right? Okay. All right.
Secondly, Catholic doctrine is very explicit that whatever their mode of temporal succession in the intermediate state, they await the resurrection of the body when they will enjoy a temporal existence.
Right. Okay.
And the Book of Revelation, in a kind of poetic vein, pictures the souls of the martyrs crying out in anticipation of receiving the clothing of their physical bodies. And St. Paul says the same thing about our desire in the future to be clothed, namely with flesh, and the intermediate state not being of that character. So I'm afraid that's just not what the church teaches.
Richard, thanks so much for listening to us in Prescott, Arizona. Here's one now from Barry in West Virginia. How does having different rites, Eastern Rite, Maronite Rite, etc., in the Catholic Church, how does this show a unified church to people outside the church?
Well, if you have the thing explained to them, I don't know that it shows it, but I think you can conceptualize it in a way. So the fact that these different rites reflect their different cultural patrimonies, and yet they all agree in their submission to the Bishop of Rome and to the Catholic faith, that's what their unity consists in, right?
Okay.
So what appears at first glance to be diversity of practice and theological expression and canonical law and things of that sort, that nevertheless these different traditions are united in their obedience to the Pope and their maintenance of the one holy Catholic and apostolic faith.
Seems to me that the growth of all these other rites or other churches, as we would say, Melkite, Maronite, that all seems to be very organic.
Well, that's exactly right, because Jesus delivered a concrete, definitive deposit of faith, but as the apostles carried it to the four corners of the world, naturally, it landed in different cultures and different embellishments grew up around it. You know,
sure.
I mean, very, very, very trivially, think about the way somebody in the modern West, Catholic or not Catholic, might go to their worship service and sing songs that reflect, say, the musical developments of American pop music since the 1950s, which, like almost everyone does now, right?
Yeah.
Even in Catholic churches, you're going to find occasionally maybe electric guitars and drums and basses and that sort of thing, right? That's a cultural development, and it would look different, say, if you were in 12th century Byzantium.
Especially not having the communication that we have now globally where you can...
Tend to find the guitars everywhere now.
Well, that's true. That is true. All right. And thank you so much for that question, Barry in West Virginia. Hey, lines are open for you right now. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, we have the answer for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Or if you prefer, text the letters EWTN to 58177. Back in a flash with lots more Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's Call to Communion on this Wednesday of Holy Week here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Of course, we have some wonderful Holy Week and Easter Sunday programming for you, and that would include our very own Mother Angelica, who will be bringing you Easter Week Scripture. That is coming up on Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Eastern, here on EWTN Radio. For a complete list of EWTN's Holy Week and Easter programming, please go to EWTN.com/radio and click on the word schedule. You'll see it in a little red box right there at the top of the page. Click on that and you're good to go. All right, if you're ready now, excuse me, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Chris in San Antonio, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio. Hello, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Dr. Anders, I've got a question for you regarding the true church that Jesus commissioned Peter to set up. And my question is, was the Eastern Orthodox Church the first church that set up? And if it was, where did the Roman Catholic Church come from?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. And I assume you know you're talking to a Roman Catholic on a Roman Catholic radio network, so obviously I'm not going to take the position that the Eastern Orthodox Church is temporally prior to the Catholic Church. I'm not going to take that position. And I'm going to do so on many grounds, one of which would be the explicit teaching of Jesus, who indicated that St. Peter was the rock foundation of the church's unity, to whom he gave the keys of the kingdom of heaven, the power of binding and loosing, the charge to strengthen the brethren and feed the sheep, and my consciousness that through history, East and West, Orthodox and Roman Catholic, acknowledged that Rome was the successor to Peter's see, and I mean Orthodox recognize that. They recognize that Rome has at the very least a primacy of honor, if not of jurisdiction. I mean that's an Orthodox belief about the Roman see, and that Rome was always, and East and West acknowledge this. Again, this is not in controversy between East and West, that Rome was the final court of appeal. Now, the difference between Orthodox and Roman Catholic ecclesiology with respect to the Pope is not on the Pope's primacy. It's not on Rome as the final court of appeal. There's a difference between having a final court of appeal and having an executive authority. I mean, the difference between the Supreme Court and the executive branch, right? The president.
Okay. All right.
And there's acknowledgement among Orthodox historians that in antiquity, churches throughout the empire had the right to appeal to Rome to decide a controversy, right? Uh-huh. Where the Orthodox hesitate is the idea that Rome could unilaterally interfere, as they understand it, in the affairs of another diocese. And that they object to, and some will even go so far as to claim that's an heretical position. Now, you know, you raise the question about the identity of the true church, and the way that Orthodox people would often conceive of that would be, since there are multiple claimants to that title, and there are different groups that would claim, say, the mantle of antiquity, they would say, well, you know, the true church is the one that accepts the doctrine of the ecumenical councils, and you have to ask the question, well, which councils are ecumenical? And then the answer you get is the ones affirmed by the true church, and so you get into kind of a circular problem. And so if you assert orthodoxy as your concept of temporal priority, you have to deal with the problem of which Orthodox, because there are multiple claimants to that position. You've got your Byzantine Orthodox, you know, the Chalcedonian Orthodox. You have the non-Chalcedonian Orthodox, which in turn are divided between those that accept the Council of Ephesus and those that don't. So you have the Assyrian Church in the east, you have the Coptic Church, and then you have the Chalcedonian churches, the Imperial Church that, you know, is best represented in, say, the Russian or the Greek churches. So which of those is the Orthodox, right? They don't agree with one another on dogma or ecclesiology. And I don't think there's any way, I don't think there's a principled way you can answer that question. I think it's an insoluble problem if you're Orthodox, right? And there are many other elements of Orthodox ecclesiology that I think it would be very hard to square with any kind of claim of temporal priority, like the whole concept of autocephaly, for example.
What is that?
That's the idea that geographical churches have a kind of local autonomy, right? And that they can, you know, be identifiable. Mm-hmm. This is an autocephalous church, and that's an autocephalous. I mean, where is that in the apostolic tradition? Jesus, that's a historical development within Orthodoxy that's critical to their ecclesiology. So obviously, I think the Catholic Church is the one that was founded by Jesus. Now, in recognizing that, I think that the Orthodox communion has an awful lot of value to bring to the Christian world, and the way the Catholic Church would look at it is the Eastern Christian patrimony, which includes Catholic and non-Catholic elements, is part of the great tradition, and the entire church can be enriched by that and benefit from it. And we appreciate that tremendously. And that's why the Catholic Church includes within its own self-conception Eastern Christianity, right? And there are plenty of Eastern Christian rites that are in communion with the Bishop of Rome. So whatever it is you like about Orthodoxy, if you like the liturgy, if you like the theology, if you like the spirituality, well, I mean, you can be Catholic and have your Orthodox cake and eat it too,
sure,
right?
Sure, sure.
But you also get unity with the Bishop of Rome thrown in to boot. And you know, so that's kind of an added plus, right? The Orthodox take the position that, well, if they hold that the Pope is a heretic, I would ask them, what dogma of Orthodox Christianity did he reject, and when was it defined by a council? And I don't think they can answer that question, right? Because I can't even tell me which ones are the legitimate councils. A Roman Catholic, I have a principled way to answer that question, right? I mean, ultimately, the ecumenical councils are those that have been validated after the fact by the Bishop of Rome.
Well, there you go. Chris, is that helpful for you, sir?
Yes, it is. I was raised Roman Catholic,
Uh-huh.
So I just wanted to be sure that I was practicing in the right faith. And so you definitely have helped me out greatly with this, your answer to this.
There's a really good book that I highly recommend you get a hold of by Aidan Nichols called Rome and the Eastern Churches. And it's a very fair-minded book. It's not terribly polemical. I mean, he's not out to bash Eastern Rite people or Orthodox people. It really is a kind of an honest historical and theological look at the relationship of the Roman Church to the various Eastern churches throughout history. And I think it's fairly told, and it's sympathetic to the Roman position, but not unfair to the Eastern position. And I found it edifying. So I recommend that to your attention.
Chris, thanks so much for your call from San Antonio. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Wednesday afternoon of Holy Week here on EWTN Radio. Let's go to Dayton now and talk with Craig, a first-time caller listening on the great Sacred Heart Radio, AM 910. Hey, hello, Greg. What's on your mind today, sir?
Good afternoon. I have a question about the priesthood.
Okay.
Where did Jesus say that only men can be priests or women cannot be priests?
Sure. Thanks. I appreciate the question. I will answer the question. Before I do, I wish to shed some light on the criterion that you presuppose, that I should care about the answer to the question, where did Jesus say? As if that somehow were a marker for Christian identity. And I would ask you, maybe rhetorically, the question, where did Jesus say that the book of Romans should be included in the New Testament canon? Obviously, Jesus never said that the book of Romans should be included in the New Testament canon. If I employ the criterion, where did Jesus say, to define the limits of Christian orthodoxy, then I guess I should throw Romans out of the New Testament canon. For that matter, where did Jesus say there should be a New Testament canon? He didn't. So I guess I need to throw out the New Testament, because Jesus never mentioned the 27 books of the New Testament. Where did Jesus say that women should receive communion? He never did. In fact, the only account of communion that we have in the New Testament is of Jesus administering it only to men, right? And I could go on and on and on with the things that Jesus was never recorded as having said, okay? Now, what we do have from Christ is a specific commission where he named individuals and gave them the charge to carry on his deposit of faith. And we know the gospel writers give us their names, right? With a promise of divine assistance till the end of the age. And we have an unbroken tradition of ordination for 2,000 years that's quite evident. I mean, it's very public. Of ordaining men only to the sacred priesthood. And we have explicit instructions from the apostles about the qualifications for ministry, and they always include maleness. So you get those in the pastoral epistles and Paul's letters and things of that sort. And then you have, of course, in Catholic theology, the way we come to know the content of Christian doctrine is threefold. We do have the witness of the scriptures that you have alluded to. We also have the witness of sacred tradition, and we have the ongoing living teaching authority of the Catholic Magisterium, which was founded by Jesus and given the specific promise of divine assistance. Whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven. And so, you know, through that three-legged stool of Christian authority, we have explicit teaching from those authorities established by Jesus that ordination is restricted to men only. Now, that doesn't say anything at all about the dignity of women. And in fact, you know, within the Catholic conception of things, the holiest creature ever to live is the Blessed Virgin Mary, a female. And I think most of us know from personal experience some holy and prayerful woman that we can't hold a candle to and recognize their centrality to the constitution of the church and to our own spiritual lives.
Yeah.
And you know, believing that a priest is a man absolutely in no way obligates me to think well of him as an individual. And I certainly know a lot of priests that are admirable people, and I know some that aren't, right? And so it's an office. And in the mind of the Catholic Church, one of the reasons that Christ may have restricted it to men only is because the priest stands in relationship to the congregation in an iconic relationship that mirrors the relationship of Christ to the church, which is the relationship of a bridegroom to a bride. And so there's a kind of liturgical appropriateness to the male-only priesthood. But remember, that doesn't exclude women from leadership or from ministry or from authority. I mean, I'm sitting right now in the worldwide headquarters of one of the largest, if not the largest, religious broadcasters in the world, founded by a Catholic nun,
yeah,
right? Who, I mean, I didn't have the good fortune to meet Mother Angelica, but my impression from talking to people around here is that she ruled with a very loving, very wise, and very iron fist. And her word was law over all the men that she ruled over, right, in this institution. And you know, the guys around here are very grateful for that leadership and look to her with a great deal of fondness.
You bet. Greg, thanks so much for your call from Dayton. Glad that you're listening to us on the great Sacred Heart Radio. It's called A Communion with Dr. David Anders. Still time for your call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Maureen is listening in Palo Alto, California, on the Ave Maria radio app. Hello, Maureen. What's on your mind today?
Yeah. Hi. It's one of my favorite talk shows.
Thank you
for what you do. So the church teaches that dying in a state of unrepented mortal sin results in eternal separation from God. So how does the church understand God's judgment in case of a person who committed, you know, serious sin, like such as ongoing infidelity, you know, is never discovered, never confessed, yet he was a devoted father of five, a generous supporter of the church, and actively involved in charitable works? So I'm just wondering, how are such cases viewed in God's light of mercy, God's mercy and justice? It sounds like, you know, it was like trying to make up for his bad works. He had, another side of him. So how does that work? But yet he died in the state of mortal sin, you know, constantly beating on his wife every opportunity.
So here's one thing that I can't possibly know. I can't know that any soul died in the state of mortal sin. That's not possible for me to know. There's a fictional story, but I'm going to reference it because I think it does a lovely job of making the point I want to make. It's the death of Ivan Illich by Leo Tolstoy. And Ivan Illich is a pretty reprehensible character. He's not an adulterer, but he's a shallow, egotistical, self-centered, narcissistic person who treats his family abominably because the only thing he cares about is his own reputation and his status in the eyes of his peers. And he has an injury that ultimately results in his death, but a slow convalescence, and he, you know, gradually comes to terms with the fact that he's actually going to die, which he can't believe because of the indignity of the thing. And in the final scene of the novella, which I highly recommend everybody read, it's a great little book. He's lapsing into unconsciousness in aphasia, and his wife, who is sort of semi-practicing Orthodox Christian, brings the priest in, whom he dismisses, then brings his son in and wants him to bless the child. And in the very last flickering moments of consciousness, Ivan Illich looks at his son and his grief and his bereavement and his lostness, and suddenly the weight of what he has done strikes him. I mean, it takes until that final moment.
Mm.
And he gestures with a hand, and he attempts to ask his family's forgiveness. And he wants to say, forgive. But because his voice is so weak, they think he says, forgo. And they think that he's shooing them away. So they leave in tears, bereft and alienated. And he dies without them recognizing his repentance. And the last line, or one of the last lines of the book, is that Ivan Illich's consciousness that basically he whose judgment matters knows. And he dies, right? And so it's a book about coming to repentance at the very last waking moments of one's consciousness. Such a thing is possible and always hidden from our sight. So I cannot in principle know that any man or woman has died in the state of mortal sin. An act of perfect contrition at the very last moment is always possible.
Maureen, thank you so much for your call. In a moment, Joseph in Plano, Texas, BJ in Tulsa. Lots more on this edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Stay with us. Hey, glad you're with us for the Wednesday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still time for your call. Barely time for your call. A couple lines open. 833-288-3986. Again, that's 833 888-EWTN. Even though we still have a half hour to go, I say barely because actually it takes a while to unpack some of these questions. And there are very few questions, David, it occurs to me, very few questions that can be answered in one sentence or two sentences. It takes a little time to unpack them.
Yes.
You just quoted Calvin Coolidge. Do you realize that? About the woman that walks up to him at a party and she says, I have a bet that I can get you to say more than three words. And he said, you lose. Gotta love that. All right, here is Joseph in Plano, Texas, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio. And Joseph, what's on your mind today, sir?
Well, actually, Dr. Andrews is a perfect person to answer this question for me. I listen to you whenever I get a chance. I always learn something. But one of the things that has always confused or I've had a question about is why are more of these Bible-believer churches becoming Catholic?
Yeah.
We believe what the Bible says, and it says this, and it says this, but they ignore other parts. When I was younger and single, I even had a girl that refused to date me because I was Catholic, and Catholics aren't Christian according to her pastor.
Right.
Yet her pastor, so why is there this, just in some cases, hatred of becoming Catholic, and why aren't more people that study the Bible becoming Catholic?
Sure. So the Council of Trent, the First Vatican Council, taught as a dogma of the faith, meaning to deny this is an heretical position, that you cannot present a man or a woman with a deductive argument that conclusively proves the truth of the Catholic faith in such a way that it will compel their intellect to assent. You cannot do it. It's not possible. Because the faith includes propositions that exceed the grasp of the rational intellect. So right off the bat, whatever value I place on apologetics, and I must place some because I do that for a living, it does not have the function of compelling people to believe the Catholic faith, right? Rather, its function is to, for people who have the will to believe, it can help remove barriers. It can resolve conflicts. It can open up possibilities. It can help them resolve maybe some apparent tension they feel between their desire for faith and their intellect, these kinds of things, but it will not compel the will to believe. So I just want to get that out of the way. Secondly, much in the same vein, Cardinal Newman, John Henry Newman, St. John Henry Newman, observed 150 years ago in his book, Essay in Aid of a Grammar of Assent, that most people, Catholic or not, don't assent to propositions because of the force of deductive argument, whatever the proposition, be it religious or otherwise. Rather, that they have certain basic intuitions about the world, about what's good, true, and beautiful, and that the proposition that is compelling to them is the one that basically affirms those basic intuitions. Okay, and modern social psychology also has demonstrated that through experimentation. So Jonathan Haidt, in his magnificent book, The Righteous Mind, makes very much the same point, but he gives you the empirical evidence that you're not going to reach somebody with argumentation, however deductively solid, if it violates their most grounded intuitions about reality. And I grew up in the Protestant world, the fundamentalist world, the evangelical world, the anti-Catholic world. And one of the basic intuitions that I had, now I received it explicitly in instruction from my forefathers in my catechisms and so forth, but it was validated to me by personal experience, was that Catholics had an anemic spirituality. They had little relationship with God. And whatever appeals they might make to sacred tradition or what have you, they were basically vapid. And that intuition was confirmed many times over because of the number of Catholics that I knew who had left the Catholic Church and become Protestant. And they would enter our churches and we would say things to them like, well, did you grow up a Christian? And they would say, oh, no, I grew up a Catholic. And they didn't laugh when they said that, like we would laugh now saying that. But they meant that seriously. And when you ask them to spell it out, they would say, well, you know, for one, I didn't understand what I was doing. I didn't know the rationale of the Catholic faith. I didn't understand how the pieces fit together. Didn't know why I went to Mass. Didn't know what the sacraments were about. Didn't know why we had a Pope, whatever, you know, what have you. And then when I became a Protestant, they would say, you know, I met a pastor who preached the Bible well and finally explained the whole thing to me, and now it makes sense, right? That would be a very common trope that I would get among ex-Catholics. And another one would be, you know, the old trope about, well, I didn't have a personal relationship with Jesus, and now I do, okay? Now, I think those are entirely false, and I reject those arguments, that line of reasoning. I'm obviously Catholic today, but let me unpack that a little bit, because I'm getting at the nature of your question. What the psychologists of meaning tell us, those that study existential meaning as an academic subject, is that people have that subjective sense of meaning when several conditions are met for them. One of them is the world has to seem coherent to them. If they live with a lot of cognitive dissonance, they don't have a coherent picture of reality. It's gonna be hard for them to find meaning. They need a sense of purpose, you know, something to get up in the morning and do that gives their life value. And then that purpose and that coherence need to be embedded in an environment that makes them feel connected to the real, so that their life feels not only coherent but significant. You know, so for example, you might have a sort of materialistic scientific worldview that was highly coherent, but left you bereft of purpose and significance, right? If you're just a cog in a materialist machine, you know, you might think, well, that makes sense from a certain point of view, but how is that supposed to matter to me, you know? And when you have those three pieces together, you have a powerful recipe for personal meaning. Now, when I look to the ex-Catholic who becomes Protestant, I think that the claim of coherence offered him by the Protestant pastor is effectively spurious. Like, I don't buy it. I don't think it's coherent, and I'll get into that in a minute. But it's usually presented, if not coherently, at least articulately, with a lot of rhetorical flourish and conviction. And if you've ever watched Billy Graham preach, the famous Protestant evangelist, Graham rarely argued for his positions, but he could assert them with the utmost confidence. He would stand up and hold a Bible in his hand, and his great Southern drawl, he would say, "The Bible says," and you just were like, I want to buy whatever he's selling. Like, the way his ethos was so powerful,
compelling, that it
was compelling. And the way most people respond to rhetoric is that pathos and ethos, you know, the emotional conviction and the sense of authority that a person conveys, can give the sort of patina of coherence. You know, if he believes it, well, it must make sense, you know. And then enough argumentation and technical language thrown in to make it seem like this person knows what they're talking to. The number of Protestant pastors that drop Greek in sermons as if that somehow gave them added authority, you know, that sense of ethos, makes things have a kind of an appearance of coherence to them. And of course, they do actually teach the narrative of the Bible in a way. And narrative is, for many people, that's all they need for coherence, to have a story to tell that they can fit themselves into.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And for one reason or another, I think they sometimes encounter that. All right. And as far as the significance and purpose goes, many Protestant churches do a good job of embedding people in a social nexus, you know, of belonging. Small groups and friendships, and they, many of them, do a very good job of enlisting lay ministry, getting people involved in activity. So the elements of seeming coherence, of purpose, and of belonging and significance are all very present. And let me tell you something: if you have the experience of subjective meaning, I mean, and it might be in the Easter Bunny or, you know, or space aliens, I don't care what it's in, right? But if you have the personal conviction that my life is deeply meaningful to me, that is very, very hard to unwind. That is extremely hard to unwind. And so in my own case, my path to the Catholic Church began with the breakdown of the coherence picture, right? I had what I thought was a coherent Protestant theology and worldview. And it took me 10 years of full-time rigorous theological study to begin to come to terms with the fact that the worldview that I thought was rock solid was actually built on very shaky foundations. And, you know, did I throw up my hands and say, well, I'm obviously going to become Catholic? Absolutely not. And so when the foundations of my Protestantism intellectually began to crumble, What I did is I started throwing sandbags at the problem. Mm. I mean, I desperately wanted to keep my Protestant faith because of those existential reasons. I didn't want to become disconnected from my community of meaning.
Sure.
And so I read everything I could get my hands on, and I tried to construct all these sort of intellectual props to qualify my Protestant conviction in a way that would enable me to keep it. And it finally became too much. I mean, my Protestantism died the death of 1,000 qualifications. And when it fell apart on me, it wasn't like I decided the next day I would become Catholic. It was I was left kind of bereft. I felt really, really adrift on the sea of existential meaninglessness and despair. But Catholicism did not loom up before me as the immediate logical alternative. And there were a lot of reasons for that, not the least of which was my experience of Catholicism as a kid, right? Which was that it was not confirmed to me, you know, mm-hmm. by example.
Yeah.
And I had to have some very specific encounters in life before the whole picture of Catholicism began to appear to me as a rational alternative to what I was leaving. And of course, it did ultimately, and I became Catholic, and I'm very glad I did. But I mean, people's religious choices and their family relationships and their, you know, being embedded in a particular kind of community, homed with an environment, having a sense of meaning and purpose and relationship, that counts for an awful lot in people's subjective choices. And so I'm very sensitive to that. And when I encounter a Protestant who's dead set in their anti-Catholicism, like, I don't hold it against them, right? The Pope doesn't either, right? Pius IX, mm-hmm. who was a pretty hardcore traditionalist, you know, conservative Pope, said he recognized when there are Protestants who grew up in an environment like that, he said you can't hold their Protestantism against them, mm-hmm. and God doesn't either, and they can be saved in their invincible ignorance of the Catholic faith, because from where they stand, it's not their fault.
Joseph, great food for thought in your question and David's response. Thank you so much for your call today from Plano. It is Called to Communion here on EWTN. Be sure to join us for the Solemn Mass of Easter Sunday. That's coming up at noon Eastern here on EWTN Television and Radio, live from the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C. For a complete list of EWTN's Holy Week and Easter programming, go to EWTN.com/radio. Click on the word schedule. That'll take you right to it. Let's go to BJ now in Tulsa, listening on the great Oklahoma Catholic Broadcasting. Hello, BJ. What's on your mind today?
Yes. So I have a question that I don't remember if I asked it on Call to Communion or if I asked it on Catholic Answers Live. But my question is from the Bread of Life Discourse, John chapter 6. Where Jesus says, "Amen, amen, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you do not have life within you." And my question is, what does that mean for our Protestant brothers and sisters that have never received the Eucharist?
Sure, sure. So Catholic tradition places a tremendous value on access to the Eucharist. So much so that when you go back to the 4th century, if you read the canons of the Council of Nicaea, you know, Nicaea was the great council about the doctrine of Christ. But when you read the canons, it's interesting. They dealt with other problems other than the doctrine of Christ. A lot of them had to deal with liturgical questions and sacramental and disciplinary questions. And one of the questions was, in those days when people were given penance for their sins, the penances would exclude them from communion, and sometimes for many years. They were pretty harsh back in those days. And the question would come up, well, if someone is, you know, on a, you know, 10-year penance for some grave offense and they become deathly ill, do you readmit them to the Eucharist? Right? And the long and the short of it was yes. Yes, in danger of death, you readmit them to the Eucharist. So they will have access to what the Church calls viaticum, that very last communion before you go. And today, you know, today our penances are not nearly so involved, but there's a remnant of that idea in the Code of Canon Law. So things like this, for example, you have a priest who is laicized for one reason or another, and he no longer has faculties to exercise his priesthood, if he runs into an emergency case, that individual, that laicized priest, like, say he sees someone expiring in the middle of the road after being hit by a car, boom, the church gives him emergency faculties. And he can hear that person's confession. He can give them last rites. And, you know, if he had opportunity, he could administer viaticum, right?
Yeah.
Probably not carrying the Eucharist and the pyx with him. But the concept is still there,
sure,
you know?
Sure, sure.
And same thing with the necessity of sacramental confession before communion, that if a person were, say, in a danger of death and had no opportunity to go to sacramental confession, the church would actually would allow them to receive communion in that very restricted circumstance, right? So that there's all this emphasis on, got to get to that communion, got to get to that viaticum, got to get there before you die. So I really want to stress that. That's a key value in Catholic life and thought. But does that mean that if a person never physically receives the consecrated species, that they are excluded from redemption? No, that's not the way the church understands this passage or the phenomenon of communion. And in fact, the church teaches that God offers sufficient grace for salvation to every soul. Every single soul, regardless of their relationship to the Christian faith, and that there will be souls in heaven who were saved without the Eucharist and without even explicit knowledge of Jesus. Now, they will not be saved apart from Jesus. They will be saved through the grace of Christ, won for us on the cross and administered by the Catholic Church, but it'll come to them in a way known only to God. And you know, anything I say beyond that is speculation. But I will speculate, knowing that this is no longer dogma. This is just a speculation,
okay,
right? There are other religious traditions other than Christianity that would give someone, for example, the sense of personal sin and guilt, the recognition of the need for a mediator, the desire to do penance or to make reparation, to know God and pay Him homage, to seek forgiveness, right? Even through a mediator.
Yeah.
And those impulses might be directed to a false object, but they would be directed from a sincere religious motive, and from, you know, and if the grace of God were active, right? Not because of, not through, but in spite of the falsehood of those rites, the proper religious sentiment would be achieved through grace, and the grace of Christ could be applied in that instance. That's the way the church understands this.
All right, very good. And BJ, thanks so much for your call from Tulsa. Let's go to Minnesota now and talk with Greg, listening online, EWTN.com. Hello, Greg. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, Doctor. Thank you for everything. If you could give us a little direction on kind of the hierarchy of graves matter with regard to lies and lying.
Sure.
You know, it's like, well, I'm a widow, and my second wife got upset with me because, well, I told her I would throw out a certain memento. I'm hovering over the trash can with the memento from my first marriage. And, you know, I just was feeling a little nostalgic, and I changed my mind, and I take it up to the attic, and I keep it. And she figures this out, and then, well, of course, I'm being accused of a kind of a hardcore lie. I was just feeling a little, well, this doesn't make sense to me. I remember reading the story about how people would hide Nazis or hide Jews from the Nazis by not lying, but just not reveal. I was just trying to spare her feelings. I mean, should I go to confession? I don't feel like I intended to deceive anyone.
I'm with you. So first of all, I'm sorry. I feel for you. This is painful from so many points of view. It's painful that your current wife would ask you to rid yourself of these tokens and mementos of a part of your life that was obviously very important to you. That's painful. That kind of could feel like a rejection and maybe a lack of respect and dignity. I'm sorry that that you had this added burden, this barrier that's come between you and your wife, who I'm sure you love and you don't want to hurt at all. I'm sorry that you have this crisis of conscience that's weighing on you. I'm just sorry all around. I mean, just my heart goes out. I can imagine what you're feeling. It's just, that's just that's just not pleasant. And I really, I'm very, very sorry. You know, here's what I would do if I were you. And you probably have already done this. I'd apologize to your wife that you said that you were going to do something and you didn't do it.
I believe he's a widower. Is that wait, correct, Greg?
First wife died. I have a second wife, and
that's the issue.
Yeah, she seems a little.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Very
so
good.
I would apologize that, you know, if you told her you were going to throw this thing out and you didn't, and you didn't keep your word and she's hurt and all that. I mean, look, I'm sorry. I didn't want to hurt you. All right. Here's the beautiful thing about confession. The questions that you're answering don't have to be answered in order to avail yourself of the benefits of confession. Very often, I will go to confession and I will say something like the following. Father, I don't even know if this is a sin. I don't know where my head was. I'm not even sure what right from wrong is here, but I'm uneasy about it. And so I'm just going to tell you what happened. I'm going to tell you what I did, and I'm going to tell you that whatever the wrong is here, I'm sorry, because I want to do the right thing. I mean, and I'm not trying to conceal anything. I'm giving you all my motives and all my reasoning and what the material act was and what the object was and who the person that was hurt was. I'm laying it all in front of you. And you can help me here if you think I need to have like a more specific contrition. I'm open to that, right? But my desire here is to do the right thing before God and before man and before you. And so for this and all my other sin, I'm heartily sorry. I just lay that stuff out in front of the priest.
Yeah, yeah.
He may not know either, right? It doesn't matter, right? You're doing your dead level best to be honest in the confessional and make a clean breast of things, right? You'll get absolution and move forward. Worrying about is it grave, is it not grave, you know, like it doesn't really that because you're Catholic and you have access to the sacrament, like you don't need to know. And the church actually doesn't draw a hard and fast line and say everything to this side of the line is grave matter, everything to that side of the line is not grave matter, is venial. It doesn't do that, and it shouldn't. It should never do that. But I mean, as a rule of thumb, grave matters are those that like profoundly offend human dignity in some way. So, I mean, sort of the quintessential grave lie would be bearing false witness in court in a capital case.
Ooh.
You know, where your false testimony is going to get somebody killed. I mean, that would be pretty evidently grave sin, right? Answering dishonestly when your great aunt asks you what you think of her new hat is obviously a very different order, right?
Yeah.
You know, but between those two, there's going to be a lot of gray area. You know, my gut tells me, I mean, no, I'm not going to say. I don't want to say. I was going to tell you my instinct on this, but I think my first impulse to just advise you to just clear your conscience, talk to your wife, go to confession, and move forward. But I will say, don't beat yourself up.
Yeah.
Don't beat yourself up. I mean, the situation that you were in is so very understandable, and honestly, I've been in similar situations myself.
There you go. Greg, thanks so much for your call. We have two questions that came in on YouTube. I'm going to try to put them together. Michael wanted to know, what are the merits and differences between Orthodox Christianity versus Catholicism? And Stavros wanted to know, will the Catholic and Orthodox churches ever reunite? And if so, what does each side need to do? What concessions would have to be made?
Ah, yes. Well, we only have about a minute left in the show, so that sort of saves me from going on too long here. But, you know, it's Christ's prayer that the church be one.
Sure.
Right. That's what he says in John 17. Kind of hard for me to imagine that Jesus is going to have unanswered prayer, right? So that remains a kind of eschatological hope of ours. You know, I think that, I could give you theological and canonical stipulations that are currently barriers to full Catholic unity. But I have a completely subjective intuition that has absolutely no Catholic weight behind it at all, that on the day that Christ solves this problem, it'll come in a way that surprises us. And it will exceed the expectations of the canonists, liturgists, and theologians. That's my intuition.
It'll be a happy day.
It'll be a happy day.
This is something, you know, we've been praying for unity for My goodness.
Ooh, 1,000 years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing small about that. No. Thank you so much for both of those questions. We could not get to Brendan on YouTube or Hayden on YouTube, but our producer, Pedro, is going to take a picture of those on the chat screen. He's very good about that. And then we will answer those questions on tomorrow's program. So I hope you folks, Hayden and Brendan, be sure to tune in for our program tomorrow. Dr. David Andrews, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We do it right here on EWTN Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern each and every weekday afternoon. Do check out the podcast whenever you wish by going to EWTN.com, click on radio, and then look for the words Podcast Central. Now with over 100 great podcasts, you know, I believe we just added 3 more podcasts this week. So there's new stuff there for you to check out. EWTN's Podcast Central, absolutely fantastic. Also, don't forget to check out our great Holy Week and Easter programming right here on EWTN Radio, Television, and Internet. On behalf of our great team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. We will see you tomorrow. Have a great day and God bless.